Our next speaker is Eddie Kay. He's the former secretary treasurer of the SEIU Local 1199. And he's advisor to the reform group you've heard about this morning in the Amalgamated Transit Union Local 1181, the New York City bus, school bus and disability van drivers. Mr. Kay, welcome to the podium.
Well, one, we have some literature, which we will be glad for you to look over. This is from the 1181. If I brought the literature from 1199, I'd need three more tables, so we decided to only do a... as long as it was Herman, it's okay. All right. So I would really love you to look it over. Sit down. I want to also introduce, before I start, Henry August and Simon Baptiste. They're rank and filers from 1181. I was given the assignment of attempting to do two unions. And that's extremely difficult. So what I did was lobby the people that are following me. So Susan Jenick has decided to waive her time. Where's that? Ed Sadowski. Ed Sadlowski. I don't see him. He's a little too big, so I didn't try him yet, but I'll try to finagle you from a distance. I got it. I already took it. Jenick's not going to speak. That's out of the question. The following, and it was and brought me back memories of the fight, Ed, when you took on a very, very difficult and necessary fight, and I remember it as it was yesterday. In a lot of ways, it involved the involvement of workers. And maybe that's the theme that I will be using, because I don't know all these fancy words, but I do know that that's what real democracy is. If it doesn't have that, then you could take it and shove it. They're all words. But involvement of workers will establish some sort of democracy. And you have to start from that. And most labor union leaders are scared shit of that because it eliminates their ability to run the union as they think is the correct way. And that's a higher level than the crooks. Don't worry, I know what I'm doing. I'm doing it for you. It's a horror. But let me start with 1199. I only have 2 hours, so I better hurry up. The following. 1199 was formed in 1932, in fact, the year I was born. And it was formed by a group of male pharmacists, Jewish, in the main, socialists, and very militant. And they formed a unique union. And their first step was that we were going to do wall-to-wall. In other words, organizing everybody in a drugstore. That eliminated what used to be trying to make a pharmacist union of just pharmacists. What it entailed was that drug clerks, porters, you were bringing in the blacks already, and then cosmeticians, you're bringing in the women. But it was this type of broadening and organizing wall to wall and making a pharmacist, a professional, understand his only strength is stopping the shop. His only strength is closing down the shop. And then his only strength is, of course, reaching out and doing much, much more. And so that's what how 1199 started. And in 1936, we had a strike in Harlem to get a black pharmacist hired. It's very nice. It's very nice. In the Andothal times, it was even bad, no less in 1936. But whatever it is, we moved, and I don't want to take much time on it, but we developed into an extremely progressive union, and come the time of McCarthyism and destroying of unions, starting, of course, in the 40s by our friend Nixon out in California, but whatever it is, and the destruction of the unions and unions destroying other unions, the UE and being destroyed by IUE, etc., etc. And what occurred is extreme red baiting until the point where we were ready to go into District 65 to save our ass. And Leon Davis decided at the last minute no. And we then went out and decided to do something different. We took 6,000 militant workers and decided to go outside hospitals. Now, that was a terrible thing. We tried to organize workers that nobody gave a damn about. Why should they? They were too black. They were too Latino. They were too poor. They were too poor white. They were had no Social Security. They had no unemployment insurance. Who the hell gave a damn about them? But somehow we created something, and when we finally settled on 1959 strike, listen to this great settlement, we got back in. That's what we want. Nothing else. And the leaders of the union looked around and were ashamed somewhat. And the members came to the meeting, and they were absolutely thrilled with the settlement. And the leaders understood, as great as they were, they understood that the victory was getting back in because every supervisor on the line, whether they liked us or didn't like us, a lot of them liked, you know, you were friends, you're never getting back in, you lost your job, et cetera, et cetera. And we got back in. And in 3 years, we had a real grievance procedure by doing the demonstrations inside the hospital, stopping the hospital, stopping the nursing home, bing-bong, sitting in the boss's office until we agreed you could go back to work, not being docked, et cetera, et cetera. So it was a different type of getting of the grievance procedure. It was a different type of getting the contract. We grabbed it. And we built the union, and I want to just leap forward because I have to deal with one aspect of that. We are now 100th, were then, in 1978 to 84, we were a union of almost 100,000, national union, 150,000, all organized by this little New York drugstore union that has grown at that particular time to 100,000. I hope you're taking notes because there is going to be a test after this, and you'll be the chief. All right.
You have six more minutes.
Yeah, I know, for to introduce it. But whatever it is.
No, you have six more minutes total.
Well, then I'll leave now. I don't have anything else to say.
That's up
to you. Because at. I did check the other times. The following. In 1984, our union, Leon Davis left it, and our union was taken over by the leadership of a woman called Doris Turner. And we entered into a time of troubles. And the time of troubles were very, very difficult. And I guess I'll give you five reasons why we took back the union, and I'll list them. We took back the union because we went from trying to fight a corrupt management and head of our union by fighting her in the palace instead of expanding it to not only organizers but extending it to rank and filers and integrating our rank and filers. So that's what we absolutely demanded of ourselves, was to create a real rank and file movement. The second thing is that she made terrible, terrible mistakes, including running a strike almost by herself and calling the strike on her own. Three, that we built an intensive organization in every single in most chapters, especially in the giant chapters like Mount Sinai. Chapter means a hospital or a nursing home in Mount Sinai, Montefiore, et cetera, et cetera. And there's where we won. We also had an extremely strong base where I come out of and led Queens, Long Island, and a place called ACOM. And we finally won. The help that we received from the National Union was also very important by individuals. Some of it was contradictory, but some of the individuals were just unbelievable. And the fifth one, as we were talking before, along came Charlie Smith. A guy comes out of DOL, Department of Labor, and we agitated through him. But understand, I don't care who you bring in, what you bring in. If you don't have the members, you could take it and shove it. And this was a big election, almost 50,000 voting. Actually, the DOL was not able to get us a rerun election. After 2 years of arguing with the incumbent, we finally agreed to the standard election that occurs every 2 years. Luckily, the DOL ran it, and we won. You know, the previous election, she got 10,000 ballots and just ripped them up and changed them. 10,000. You know what it is to do that? She had a crew of 25 working all night. So this combination of intensive organization of the rank and filers created a structure that made it necessary, and the DOL did help. I originally was of the opinion, hell with all these government agencies, et cetera, and I have changed. I changed then. I changed my mind when the Teamsters moved there and put in Cary. And so it is a was a very strong help, and we finally won 52-46 with 2% going to another one. I won't even mention Local 78 because there, as you know, we also made a different type. Let me now jump. This one where the rank and filers in Local 78 decided that they will throw out some of the corrupt leadership from their local and from the Mason tenders, and was able to gather in a tremendous amount of political help, and eventually the head of the International caved in when 83 political letters went into him. Plus, we had an organization where 1,300, the local was about 2,600, we did house visits to 1,300 members. We're talking about face to face. You could not say you did a house visit and left literature, nor do a house visit and see the spouse. You had to do a house visit to see the voter. And we finally won by 100, and the victor was a Dominicano, was a little too black, and they all thought he was dumb. And he's running the best union in that Mason tenders. It's a beautiful thing to see, Edison Severino. Now, jumping again into a third union, 1181. 1181 is of the International ATU, Amalgamated Transit Union. It's probably one of the big disgraces in our labor movement. Not so easy to say that because there are a lot of disgraces. A lot of competition. Thank you, brother. Maybe you read my notes, but I couldn't even see that. But what we're doing here now, and this is going on as we talk. We're going on as we talk. We started back a couple of years ago, and even before that, members were fighting back as individuals, and of course got knocked down, knocked out, eliminated as individuals. And then the situation occurs that we attempted about 2 years ago and the accessory drivers. You ever see them? That's the blue and white buses that run around. They went to AUD, and AUD sent them to the attorneys that used to work for me at 1199, Levy and Eisner, which is now Levy and Ratner, et cetera, and Carl Levine, and they did half and half. Then the educational buses, drivers, and escorts. Escort is a person that sits in the bus and makes sure that the kids are okay. These are all the educational buses, et cetera, et cetera. I'll try to finish up. They have to talk, though. The following. We were faced with, I would ask your indulgence.
You got 2 minutes, and if you want to, no, no, listen, listen. Solidarity includes giving everybody a chance to talk.
Yeah, yeah, I understand that. I don't want to claim.
We'd love to hear these gentlemen, but you've got to get them on the floor right now.
Okay, they will.
We only have this room for a certain amount of time. And if you're not out of here in a few minutes, it's going to be bad for you. No, I'm serious.
If it'll be that bad for me, I could say the hell with it. I couldn't care less.
You can do
the,
that.
I don't appreciate that remark. And I've heard those remarks way before. We are faced with a union that is totally, totally controlled by the mafia. We're talking about for 30 years. And we're now being proven of that fact in court. I want Henry, come on up, Henry, please. Henry is one of the rank-and-file members, and he's going to describe in a couple of minutes how we're doing the fight back. How we're doing the fight back. Go ahead, Henry.
Thank you, Eddie. I started myself fighting with those people, and as you know, I was by myself. I lost. Eddie came with helping us to keep going with the fight, and right now we are 18 Rockefeller members. Probably we have 100 members who believe on having a democratic union. And the fears, the intimidation we are receiving kept the members away from us. But with the leaflet we are giving, the buttons, the meetings, we have two meetings every month. We feel we are making little progress. The people right now who are fighting against us, they believe we are every day getting stronger and stronger. But like I said, the members still fear. They have a lot of fears, the intimidation. Because sometimes they feel like they're going to lose their jobs. But we're getting there. Thank you, Eddie.
He's a little too modest. We got almost 2,000 signatures from members who knew that what they were signing. We have their names and phone numbers and creating an organization, attempting to create an organization in each garage. A garage is where the buses come out of. By the way, we're not only fighting the mafia within the union, as you might know from some research done, that Atlantic Bus is not exactly kosher and that they're totally controlled by the mafia. And so is Logan Bus Company. I'm talking about the bosses. The next speaker is a gentleman that went down with three other people and myself to Florida to appeal to the international board. The head of the international, the president, already turned down on our appeal that they robbed the election. Now get the atmosphere. There were 20 people indicted in 2005. 17 mafia people, including Matty the Horse Iannello, who the hell knew him until I joined this group. He's the head of the Genovese crime family. He pleaded guilty. We have his allocution. And he acknowledged working with the officers of Local 1181 since the 90s. He's also indicted in Connecticut and et cetera. Okay. The second thing is... Okay, yes, he's going on. It seems to be a movement to shoot me, but whatever it is... Okay, go ahead, Simon. Simon, he went down to Florida and very bravely defended our cause. You got to speak into the microphone. Yeah.
Thank you very much. I was in Florida to present before the International Executive Board our appeal because the president for the International, Warren George, did rejected our request to remove our local leaders from our union. Because of that, we were about to sign a contract, and then the contract is a mess because our president and his team, they were too weak to represent the workers. So I was part of the team that went down to Washington to present before Warren George, the president, but before the whole about 28 members of the international, our cry for help. So we did our best to present to them our concern, and then all leaflets and materials and articles, all the indictments from the federal government about the mafia participation in our union. Without, we believe that we're working for nothing. So I really wasn't ready to speak here. I'm on my way to Washington, but I just stopped by, and Eddie's, as usual, always unpredictable. I find myself that I have to stand up here and say something, but... you know, that's where I'm going to be. Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
I'm very sorry I could not conclude.
Thank you very much. I want to recommend everyone to the discussion section after this. There'll be ample opportunity to speak to Mr. K, if you can get a word in. And... there'll be lots of opportunity to speak to the other speakers as well. I'd like to introduce Susan Jenick, who is an attorney, has served as the in-house counsel for a number of trusted Teamsters locals, and she's the former assistant attorney general for the New York State Labor Bureau, and, of course, she's a former executive director of the AUD. It's a pleasure to welcome Susan to the podium.
I already have the time is up sign in front of me.
No, you have at least 10 minutes. Since he took 5 of them, at least.
Thanks, Eddie. Good to see my good friend, Eddie Kay. And it's great to be here with AUD people and to have this conversation and review of what we've all been doing over the last 20, 30, 40 years to fight union corruption. I have... two things that I'm going to be talking about today. One is the assigned task that I have, which is to discuss the trusteeship of Teamsters Local 966. The other thing I want to talk about, which I think we all need to talk about, is where are we and where should we go from here as far as union democracy and union corruption. 966 is Teamster Local that for a very long time was basically set up not to be a real local, but to be a part of a family union enterprise. In this case, it was not what we call the mafia. It was the McCarthy family. A guy named Jack McCarthy set up a group called National Consultants and was investigated and by Congress. I think it was in the 60s. He went to jail for labor racketeering several times. His wife went to jail for labor racketeering. They had 9 children, and their children carried on the family business. When the local was put in trusteeship in 1994 after the Independent Review Board brought charges against the local officers, and Ron Carey then appointed Gene Moriarty to be the trustee. And after a short period of time, in December 1994, I was brought into the local to be in-house counsel. And when we got there, Brian McCarthy was the attorney representing the attorney representing Local 966 and the Local 966 benefit funds. His brother, Randy McCarthy, was the attorney representing National Consultants Association, which was most of the employers that the union negotiated with and had collective bargaining agreements with. So the two brothers were managing this family enterprise, which included not only Local 966, but a number of other independent locals that they had, an IBEW local. You know, they were diversified. They had more than one local that they were involved with. There were serious problems with the pension fund, and we were not able to initially remove the employer trustees from the pension fund, who then immediately became represented by Brian McCarthy. The pension investments were basically done through a stockbroker. There was nothing like an investment consultant or an investment manager. There was a stockbroker who was a friend of theirs who would make certain recommendations that they invest in things that people who know a lot more about stocks than I do didn't even understand or had never heard of. It was junk bonds and, you know, a lot of other very risky investments. The health fund that they had was one of the bases of the enterprise that they were operating. And it was basically low-cost health insurance. And it was low-cost because it was done through this, you know, Taft-Hartley benefit fund. It provided a very low level of benefit. And it was difficult for the members who were supposed to be covered by this to actually, you know, get any benefit of the health benefits that they were supposed to have. When they would submit their claims for payment, it was delayed. They got paid a low percentage. You know, there were all kinds of things that were done to keep the cost low. Because it was low, it was something that the McCarthy family used to market to other employers and to independents, the independent locals. And that was the way they used to build their base of operations. And some of the employers that we found that were supposedly employers that had contracts with the union, there was one company that we knew about that was called Sparta Dairy, Sparta, New Jersey. So Mark Liss, who then was working for the trusteeship, said, well, he decided to take a ride out to the Sparta Dairy. It turned out to be a Sparta Dairy Queen. And the guy who owned it was the brother of somebody who had a blueprint business in Queens and heard about this great health insurance plan that he could get into. So those were the kinds of employers, many of the employers that were involved with the local, and we, you know, repeatedly had to investigate the employers to determine whether they were real and had members or whether this was just a scheme to provide cheap health benefits for the employers themselves. So one of the things we were doing was investigating employers and then eliminating them. So the local was, in fact, losing members by this process. We had to bring a lawsuit against the employer trustees, and as a result of that lawsuit, after many years, we finally had them removed as trustees, and we could finally start turning the pension fund around and investing the investments properly. By that time, the investment, the pension fund was actually in such bad shape, we had to freeze the benefit accrual. So the trusteeship was in the position of going to the members and saying, you know, bad news. You're not going to be accruing any benefit. The employers are still going to pay a contribution into your pension, but you're not going to get anything, any additional benefit in the future. We had to reduce the health benefits as well. I mean, things were in a shambles. And in spite of that, The members started coming to meetings, and the members started coming to educational events, and they started filing grievances, and they started responding to the attempt to make this into a real local union. We had, I don't know how many, I mean, it was somewhere between 50 and 100 arbitrations that we did in the first year. We had a strike in the blueprint industry after about a year and a half, and that was a very difficult strike. The industry was basically composed of people who had, using old-fashioned technology, produced blueprints through these machines that have very smelly chemicals, and you know, it was a very old-fashioned industry. It was obviously shrinking. It was being challenged by technology. The members that were in the union were some of the lower-skilled, less-skilled workers. We had a long strike, and the blueprint industry was the base of the employers that supported the McCarthy family. Ultimately, we did get the workers back in that strike. We did end up getting another contract there. The pluses, though, were, I mean, the main advantage to having that strike with the under the trusteeship was that the other employers who we had to negotiate contracts with saw what was going on. You know, it went on for about a year and a half. The other employers saw that we were hanging in there. We were making noise about it. We were picketing them. We were stopping their deliveries. And the other employers dealt with us a lot more seriously in the contract negotiations. Ultimately, in my opinion, that trusteeship was a success. There are elected officers. There are people who continue to run for office. There are contested elections each time they have an election. And the local, the benefit funds are on their own feet. The local is financially secure and stable right now, and I think is in pretty good shape. The McCarthy family isn't there any longer, although Randy McCarthy still represents some of the employers that they deal with, but at least Brian McCarthy isn't representing the union. And so the benefit funds are doing okay. The lessons that are learned from that, I mean, what I can take away from, how did that happen? How did that local reach success under a trusteeship when so many others did not? I mean, there have been so many failures that we've seen or locals that just sort of ended up being trusteed into another local or merged into another local. I think the most important thing, as everyone is saying here today, is the membership, education, and involvement. That's also the most difficult thing. I think the most challenging road for us to go down. Finding new and honest leaders. I mean, in my many years of doing this kind of work, I think probably a lot of us have suffered many disappointments. You know, there have been people that I worked with, helped get elected, and then found out, you know, within months of that election, they were taking payoffs from employers. I mean, people that I, you know, believed were good, honest union Democrats who either, you know, were hiding it all the time or got in power and turned. I mean, we see those things happening. In Local 966, it was challenging because the workers tended to be low-wage workers. And what we would see repeatedly is that somebody who would get involved in the union, who was, you know, very active and capable and skilled, would soon thereafter find a better job. They'd find a job, you know, that was going to provide them and their family with a better living, and they would move on. So it was very difficult to provide the education to those workers and develop the leadership. And I think in any union, whether it's a union under trusteeship, that is the biggest challenge that we face. I think in Local 966, we had a lot of good staff people. And, you know, again, it's kind of an individual thing, whether you're going to find the right staff people to turn the local around. I know I learned pretty early on that it's a lot easier to be a dissident complaining about what somebody else is doing than to be the person inside the union trying to run it, you know, democratically and honestly and militantly. That is a very difficult job. And local union leaders who take on that job, I think, deserve the support of everyone, and we should all be mindful of that. We had some differences among the staff. A lot of the people who were on staff were TDU members or came out of TDU. There were differences among the staff at certain points as to whether the goal of the staff and the goal of our efforts should be to build TDU or to build the local union. And those kinds of tensions, you know, created some difficulties, and some people moved on. I think that's something we need to talk about in the union democracy movement. Yes, it's important to have a rank-and-file organization, but after all, what's the point? You know, what is our ultimate goal here? Our ultimate goal is to build a decent labor movement. Another lesson is that the officers don't go away and have to be forced out. Eileen Sullivan, who will be speaking here today, will talk about Locals 295 and 851, which had court-appointed trustees, and 295 in particular. There was never anything done to remove anyone from the local. There was no discipline against any member of that union by the court-appointed trustee. If you don't do that, they wait around. You know, they keep their hands in, and when the opportunity is there, they strike and they come back. In 966, what ended up happening is that Vinny Sembrato, who had been the president of the local, was removed, was disciplined. He still appears, and this is something that I think is a bit of a change in the labor movement. Sembrato continues to run this operation with the McCarthy family, and now they're mostly in independent local unions. And they go around and they try to steal members from local unions that are trying to do a good job, or maybe local unions that are honest but, you know, aren't being as effective as they should be. In the Teamsters Union, there was an injunction imposed against Sembrato that he cannot raid any other Teamster local. And that's been very useful for the Teamsters in New York City and New Jersey. And I think another lesson is that you have to deal with what we've always called the business unionism issues. You know, for a while, among labor movement activists, business unionism was like a dirty word and frowned upon. But you have to make sure that you're operating the union financially in the black. If you lose money, if you use up all the union's finances, you're not going to be able to function and carry on. I mean, these are like basic things that I think we can't ignore. Maybe we need to go beyond that, but we can't ignore it. The member servicing, actually negotiating collective bargaining agreements, handling the grievances, you know, these are all critical. And, of course, organizing, and in Local 966, that has been especially important because they're in industries where, you know, the companies are going out of business. One of their big companies when we first got there was Fuji. They did film processing. Well, guess what? You know, not too many people are taking their film into any store to be processed anymore. They have the digital. So those are the business unionism tasks that I think can't be ignored and are a necessary condition, maybe not sufficient, but a necessary condition for reforming a local union. I want to turn briefly to where do we go? Where are we and where do we go? I think we need to congratulate ourselves. I think we have come very far from where we were 20 years ago. 20 years ago, the President's Commission on Organized Crime put out a report identifying four international unions as controlled by organized crime. Three of them have had government action taken against them, and whether they're perfect or not, and I don't think any of them are, I don't think any of those unions we can say are controlled by organized crime in the way they were in the past. The fourth is the longshoremen, and there is now a pending civil RICO action against the longshoremen. And one of the things that I do now is I work with the Longshore Workers Coalition and I'm optimistic about the future of that union as well. So I think we can say, you know, in spite of examples like ATU 1181, in general, organized crime does not control unions in the way it did in the past. And I think we have been remarkably successful. But that success, in some ways, we're a victim of that success. AUD, you know, doesn't have the same kinds of horror stories that we had in the past. We don't have, fortunately, you know, someone like Bruno Bauer being murdered on the job in 1986. You know, we don't have those horrible things happening, and that's a wonderful thing, but at the same time, it changes, I think, what AUD could best be doing. And so I want to throw out a couple of ideas I have. And one of the ideas is that AUD could serve as a resource for the many local union officers who are trying to do a good job, who are trying to run a democratic union, and they need some help. And I thought AUD could develop best practices that would assist them in the area of elections. I mean, we have a lot of literature for dissidents who are running for office to prevent an election from being stolen by just turning that around a little bit and saying, you know, this is a model election rules, or we could do training for election officers who could be hired by a local union so that when a local union wants to hire an independent officer, there would be resources available to them. We could set procedures, model procedures for internal union trials, model hiring hall rules, and provide that kind of resource to local union officers, along with what AUD has always done very well, which is to assist those union members who are fighting the corruption that does still exist in hopefully fewer and fewer unions. Thank you.
Yeah, our next speaker has a case study of Roofers Local 30. He's Mike Sullivan, who's a former reform leader in that local, and I'm afraid this is going to be a case study of kind of a disastrous outcome. At least that's what it says on my paper. Mike, are you here?
Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Mike Sullivan. I'm a member of Roofers Local 30 in Philadelphia. A little background. My father come from a labor background. My father was a business agent and a reformer in the Painters Union in Philadelphia, Local 703. Little background. Roofers Local 30 had a commercial and a residential Local 30 and Local 30B. Classically, Local 30 did the commercial industrial work. 30B did residential work. I started as a helper when I was going to college for a year or so and then became a member in 1971. John McCullough was our business manager. He was a decent enough labor leader, but he was associated with criminal elements. He was assassinated in his house, murdered a week before Christmas in 1980 by the Philadelphia mob. And I believe one of his associates was involved in the murder, was never proven. I became a journeyman roofer in 1971. I was a foreman, and I was appointed a steward in 1977. After John McCullough was murdered, a fellow by the name of Stephen Treats, who didn't actually take over the union, put his crony in there to run the union, a guy by the name of Jack Kincaid. He just ran the unions from the sidelines. He ran a flight club, which was a training ground for business agents. And he incorporated a lot of the local area fighters into the union who were organizers and stewards, and they became his police officers. Trates himself was an ex-fighter, and he was a thug for Teamsters Local 107 in Philadelphia. He became the actual head of the union in 1986, the early part of, I guess, January 1986. The FBI installed listening devices sometime thereafter. It was a notorious spot where they would bring in contractors and roofers and members of the roofers union into the conference room, and they would, you know, beat the hell out of them. It's about what it was. They would put five professional fighters on one person, and whether it was a contractor or a member. If you talked about the trades family in a bar on a Friday afternoon when you're having a couple beers, the next Friday you were in the union hall, and five of these professional fighters would beat the hell out of you. If you wanted to stay roof, and if not, you just took off. Anyhow, within a year, they discovered the bugs, and within a year, Trates' two sons and 10 other union officials were indicted on bribing city judges, extorting money from contractors, and doing favors for the mob. All were convicted in November of 1987. The election was called for. At that time, the U.S. Attorney's Office had started a civil proceeding to install a trusteeship. And they were actually, by the time they were both going on at the same time, the criminal trial and the civil trial. They were convicted in November, mid-November of 87, and within 2 weeks they called a special election. Well, it was the first time anybody had a chance. Nobody spoke at a union meeting. And it was the first time people had a chance to, you know, so they're all going to go to jail. Maybe we can actually make a union out of this. And a lot of, there was a group of us, about 40 of us got together and said, let's see what we can do here. When we went to the nominating meeting, we found out that wasn't going to be the case. The guys were threatened. I was the apprentice instructor. I was immediately fired. Along with my boss, who had nothing to do with my candidacy, but they fired him anyhow. They posted, they when they're calling the nominations, they found out somebody was going to run, they postponed the meeting. And a week later, they actually had the nominations. And the nominations, with the union's attorney present, everybody was, we had a group of about 30 or 40 of us, but we put up a slate of four officers and five executive board members, and everybody was just subjected to all kind of, it wasn't like just five or six fighters. They had about 80 to 100 guys that were fighters and thugs, like surrounded everybody. But the union was in the process, the trial was going on, the civil trial was still going on, so, you know, although there was a lot of intimidation, nobody was physically assaulted. We did wind up losing the election. There were several grounds to appeal the election, and there was tons of intimidation going on outside the meeting. Guys that were supporting me, they were going to their houses in the middle of the night, in the morning, dragging them out of the houses and taking them for a car ride. But this is with the convicted officials and the new guys that they were appointing to take our jobs, and threatening them and scaring the living shit out of them. So we were starting to lose people right off the get-go. We wound up losing the election. I mean, we had so many grounds for appeal to overturn the election. They were using the union hall, the union van, taking officials, their candidates around. The guy that ran for the head of the union, the guy that ran against me, was one of their associates. And in 20 years that he had a membership, he only had 1,000 hours. He only worked 1,000 hours. But he was well known as one of the thugs in the whole Northeast Philadelphia. We talked to the U.S. attorney after the election with all these grounds for appeal. The U.S. attorney advised us not to go to the Department of Labor, that I'm sure the judge will handle this when he takes over the union. That U.S. attorney was appointed later by the judge to his law firm. 6 members of our slate testified at the civil trial about the threats and intimidation that was happening during the election. before the union actually appointed the trustee, who was his nephew, one of our supporters was assaulted in the hiring hall by one of the business agents, and he was beat up pretty badly. That was in May of 1988. The judge appointed his nephew in June of 1980, a month later after the assault, and nothing was done to the business agent. He was still allowed to keep his job. I met with the trustee maybe about 3 or 4 months after that, and in the room next to me had the guy was the business manager, the hand-picked business manager, and he wanted me to shake hands with him, and he would give me my job back if I just, you know, let everything go. I'd just like to restate that I was misled by the U.S. attorney. We kept the group together. We figured we were going to stick it out. We had no choice. We were committed. You know, if we wanted to stay roofing, we had to keep going with it. The next election was going to be in June of 1989. We were employed from the time of the first election while the judge was deciding on the trustee. Once the trustee was appointed, all of a sudden we noticed we couldn't get any work out of the hiring hall. That doesn't make any sense, but that's what happened. It was sending a real bad message to all the members. We couldn't get a job, and they were in cahoots with the contractors. We've heard this 1,000 times today about the contractors. They can't do it alone, these corrupt officials that run these unions, without the help of the contractors. So we stuck it out. There was various instances at union meetings where I was surrounded by 20 to 30 goons and the thugs. I couldn't get up on the floor and say a word. We had our wives called the judge. He finally made the trustee, his nephew, go to one of the meetings. He was standing right next to me when I had 30 thugs around me. He did absolutely nothing, and nothing happened at the next meeting. I mean, we got to the point, and they would just shout us down. We couldn't say a word, even though there was 15, 20 of us. And each meeting, we lost more and more members, you know, more and more of our following. And it just sent a negative message to members. But we still thought we could have pulled it out if we got a break or two. We got some information. You know, I got a lot of help from Herm here at AUD. And I had an attorney, the only attorney in the city of Philadelphia that would help us. Not one labor lawyer would come out and help us, a contract attorney for a business. And he gave us a little bit of advice, what advice he could manage, what he knew about labor law and what he could find out. I through writings and stuff like that, I did acquire a couple of documents, and one was about union dues. So when we came to the elections, the following election in 1989, which was a year and a half later, I happened to notice that they weren't paying union dues, all these just got elected officials. And their international dues was being paid out of the union treasury. So they hadn't paid anything. So when they were nominated, I filed an appeal that that they be thrown out. And the judge called an immediate hearing and ruled in their favor, that there was a past practice and it was okay. So we denied our appeal. There were no issues ever addressed by the trustee. The hiring hall. We had 3 assaults in the hiring hall. The first one I talked about before he was appointed, and 2 after. The 2 assaults after the trustee were appointed, the stewards, the union goon stewards that did the assaulting, were then appointed business agents and approved by the judge. Like I said, the intimidation at the meetings just went on and on and on. There was absolutely no financial accountability. They had this phony audit that Pete Marwick Main did. It was the same audit that the union's accountants did. It looked like it was written word for word from the union accountant. You know, there was one accountant that the union hired, and they found this is how I found out about the one transgression I forget what they call it, what an accountant does, but they called up one of the members and said, did your son have this appendectomy done? He said, I don't have a son. I have 2 daughters, you know. So right away, it was tipped to me. And then it made sense to me that this Crawley ran against me, he had the check cashing agency. That's where they were laundering the money out of the health and welfare and the pension funds. You know? And two made four. So after we got no help, I guess I got a little ahead of myself. I got up to the second election. But when I got no help from the trustee, our only alternative is we filed internal union charges against the entire officers of the union, against the goons, the stewards. And I knew this would have to bring the international in because they can't try themselves, although they would have liked to have done that. Well, the international in the beginning was seemed very helpful. Like they really wanted it. I think they didn't like these fellows and were willing to help us. And that they got paid a visit by the court trustee, and that was the end of that. They decided they were going to have a trial, but it was an absolute farce. And they didn't render a decision until almost a year after our second election, and most of us were out of the union and we had no work. So it was a... So we got no financial accountability at ever. The only thing that seemed strange was that the trustees' bills were quite enormous in the first 3 years in the $2 million range. The union treasury was going down, and none of the members were getting anything for it in return. There was absolutely no democracy at all. And to this day, not one member other than our slate has ran for office. They just had an election about a month ago, and it was the faction split down the middle, one side against the other. Not one member in the 20-some years. When I ran, there was 3,000 members in the union. There's 500 now. So I guess if the judge's plan was to destroy the union, he succeeded. It definitely wasn't to restore democracy to the union and let the hard-working guys have a shot at it. The other thing is, it seemed like any press that we got from the Philadelphia Press, it was almost like it was manipulated. We were always negative, treated in a negative vein. Like we get an article in a Sunday paper, it was like we were a bunch of crybabies and just stirring things up. And really, we never got a fair shake. The one of the contractors who actually stood up for a couple of our workers, the union, he got a visit from two of the union officials, and the following day, all his men were pulled. This is why the trustee's in office. And he was just told to file it or do something. So I wasn't working. I took four or five of our guys that I was roofers, fellow roofers, and we went over there and we went to work for him. And we worked there for 2 or 3 years. So he was one of the few. Okay. I guess I'm going to have to wrap this up pretty soon. Out of the 40 people that were with me at the start, there's only three left in the union. Two of them were guys that ratted on us, and one guy, Dave Suda, is still there. Another thing about Joe Crawley and the check cashing agency, a friend of ours who was with the Sheriff's Department in Philadelphia, who was in charge of collecting taxes, and they went to collect the taxes on the check cashing agency, and the sheriff of Philadelphia was paid a visit by the court-appointed trustee and told him, your investigation's over. I guess I want to end a little bit, but it's very negative, but I hear now and I see here that it does work. It helps. You know, we didn't get it. It was a bad situation. We had a judge. I don't know what his agenda was. I guess to make his nephew rich. I'm not sure. But it certainly wasn't to restore democracy to our union. But I hear with the Teamsters and that Ed Steers, what a great job that he did. And he had an unbelievable. He was sincere, you know. And when you get that, it'll work, you know.
Is that a federal judge?
Yes, it was. Yeah, I was told they were, you know, they were up on a cloud here. But I'm not that naive anymore. Does it work? I think it does. Ours was a bad situation, you know. What do you do to rectify that when you get in a situation like we were in? I don't really know. Because they're God at federal level. They get removed by an act of Congress, and an act of Congress only. So I don't know what you do. I'd like to thank Herm for giving me an opportunity to vent a little bit. I guess it's good. It's therapeutic.
And, what are you doing now? Are you working?
No, I haven't worked in the Roofers Union. I'm actually collecting my pension now. But I'm actually driving a truck and working in a warehouse. I worked two jobs for 10 years. I worked for that iron and roofing, and I worked for the warehouse at night, and I got all my kids through college and stuff like that. So I just finally gave up the second job. But it was a hell of an experience, and I wish it had worked. I wish it would have worked out for all the guys that were with me. You know, okay.
Well, here's to the Fighting Irish, huh?